Accession number 32527, Reel 1.
Robert Jaffer, Reel 1. Where and when were you born?
10th of May 1920, born in Birkenhead.
And what did your parents do?
My parents had just come back from Canada, actually. They were a well-known Liverpool family. But my dad came back and he lost everything on the crossing over. He sold everything he had. When he got to Liverpool, he had to do something. So I think he took a pitch in Liverpool Market, and then he moved to Blackpool. Is it still taped?
Yes.
We moved to Blackpool, and he had a pitch on the Pleasure Boots. He did rather well there. He came to Torquay to see his brother one year. And he thought, what am I living in Blackpool for when I could come to Torquay? So he put his five children in the back of his Austin 7 that he had. We were all very young, of course. I was only 9. And he drove us down to Torquay. That's how we got to Torquay. 1929, that was.
And where did you live in Torquay?
Tor Hill Road. Just not far from the town hall, you see. Not far from Castle Circus.
So what did he do when you got to Torquay?
Well, of course, I went to school. My dad had a shop in Fleet Street, and we sold kitchen gadgets and things like that. And I went to school. I went to Abbey Road School, a church school, in Abbey Road, only a small school. I left there at 12 and went to boarding school, St. Boniface College in Plymouth.
Did you enjoy your school days?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And what were you good at?
Nothing. No, that's not quite right. I think I was an average, just average.
Did you enjoy sports?
Well, I would have done, except that I was never any good at it because I wore glasses. So we used to play rugby, but I was all right, but I couldn't see all that good. My eyesight wasn't too bad, but it was no good if you couldn't play cricket. I did play cricket, and I liked it very much, but I never did anything outstanding in it at all.
Did you have any hobbies?
Pardon?
Did you have any hobbies as a boy?
As a boy, I used to like carpentry a lot, but not really. I came from a big family. There were 10 of us.
10 children?
Yes.
Goodness me.
6 are still alive.
Really?
There were 6 girls and 4 boys. Yeah. I had a good childhood.
Yes.
It was very good.
And when did you leave school?
Well, I don't know what standard it would be now. When I had my matric, you did school certificate and then matric. I should think matriculation was, that was the leaving certificate sort of style. And I think that would be somewhere around perhaps O level, might be a bit, not as high as A level.
And what did you do then?
Then I went in my father's business. I was 17 when I left school. Went in my father's business. And then I had friends who were at school with me. And I did actually join the Rover Scouts, just for somebody to get to know somebody, because when you go to boarding school, you have no friends in your hometown. Mm. And that's the worst thing about it. I wouldn't agree with boarding school in future, really, though I benefited, I think, a lot from it, and I liked it. But I'd had no friends in my hometown.
That isolates you, doesn't it?
Yes. So anyway, I joined the Rover crew, and I had friends from school who lived in Torquay. And Chamberlain, life was pretty drab, really, because in those days you didn't go on to university. I never knew anybody who went to university. If you got matric, you left and you could get a job practically anywhere if you'd got that. Anyway, I went to my father's business, and then along came 39, the troubles and all that, and Chamberlain, we used to talk about this, and it was obvious to anybody that war was coming. Even though he did come back waving his bit of paper saying peace in our time, he did. And the next day he introduced conscription and he appealed for any able-bodied men to join the Territorial Army. Some of my 3 friends, it wasn't any great patriotism, but it was a question where we owed the country something, And we knew, we thought we'd be called up more or less right away at 18 years old, you see. So we joined the Territorial Army together. We said, well, let's join up the same unit together, which we did.
And that was a local Torquay unit?
The local Torquay unit. We went down one day and signed up, and they sent us home again for a week or two, and then told us to report back. And when we reported back, they'd formed this, put us in, we had no choice, we just put in the Army Medical Corps.
What did your mum think about that?
Mum?
Yes.
I don't think they thought much at all about it. I think it was just sort of the sort of thing you did. medical. I mean, nothing special about it. I wouldn't have chosen the medical corps, especially when I got in it later, because I think it's the toughest corps in the army when you go into action, because they send you where the fighting's the worst. You see, I think it's the toughest corps in the army. I was glad to get out of it. Anyway, do you want me to carry on?
Yes.
Right, so, well, of course, that was in the spring. I think it's on, I think they're April, that we joined. And Chamberlain came back with his appeal in September, you know, so we joined up there. No, it wasn't. No, it didn't. That was when the war was declared. In April it was, wasn't it?
April 39.
April 39, yes. So we went down and joined. And they were all talkie boys, mostly grammar school boys. But the trouble with that, I never joined a territorial unit again. Because when you rejoined, everything was all arranged. We just went in as privates, and privates we would stay. Because it seemed to be that anybody with an education didn't get any promotion. Well, there was no promotion when we were there anyway. It was all made up, you see. But everybody with anybody was made a sergeant. The qualification was you had to be able to shout the loudest, swear the loudest, blaspheme the loudest, and bully. That didn't worry us. We were only kids anyway.
What sort of duties did you do? Did you go into any training camps?
No. Nope. When the war broke out, we went down to Maristow, just out on the Tavy, you know, outside Plymouth. Very nice place, and we stayed there till April. We were supposed to be trained, but they didn't do much. When we went to France, we didn't know as much as anybody with knowing first aid now. They were just did nothing but mess about all the time, and we played at it now and again, but only trivial. And in April, I think it was April the 1st, because we used to laugh about it, we went to France then. And of course, we were only in France just over 2 months.
Right, so if I just take you back a bit.
Yes.
So after the war broke out, you went down to Plymouth.
Yes.
And you were training there with regular army or just...
No, just
the territorial unit.
Just the same territorial unit. The training just hardly existed. We did a bit of first aid, but nothing serious. They could, in that 6 months we were down there, given us intensive training and turned us out first-class nursing orderlies. Really, who knew our job? If you had somebody for 6 months, you ought to be able to do something with them. But they didn't. Nobody bothered.
What sort of equipment did you have?
None. Well, you mean medical equipment?
Yes.
Oh, well, it was a mobile unit, you see, and a casualty clearing station is the nearest to the front where you can get an emergency operation. It was based on the First World War, because they scrapped it later. And we joined the 4th First Southern. And when the war broke out, they broke it up into three, the 11th, 12th and 13th. Casualty Clearing Stations, CCS, you see. And the idea was you work together, leapfrogging forward or backward. Of course, it didn't work, you see. In practice, it was the First War. It was designed for static warfare, so it didn't work.
And what was each unit consisting of?
We had two surgeons. The rank of a surgeon is major. We had about six or eight of the doctors, local doctors, who were captains, and we had three chaplains. That was about all.
And then
it wasn't a big unit.
The nurses.
Pardon?
Yourself.
Yes, there's us. But it was what annoyed us was that it was just a waste of time. Mind you, when we did go into action, I think we did a wonderful job. How we did it, in our ignorance, I don't know. But
while you were training, did you have to do a lot of marching and?
Oh, yes, I would. All this squadron and route marching things. I can't see what the good squadrons. I don't know what squadron is for in the army, because it doesn't do any good. It doesn't teach you to fight.
What sort of weapons were you?
We had no weapons.
None at all.
We weren't trained in there. We weren't trained in.
So you didn't even have anything for personal protection.
Nothing. No, RDMC wasn't armed at all. So not that it would have made any difference. We wouldn't have known how to use them anyway.
So the whole unit was a mobile unit.
Yes.
So what did you have? Austin KTs?
Pardon?
Did you have the Austin K2 ambulances that you
went? No, we had no transport at all. We relied on the Ordnance Corps to supply us with transport, which of course never worked when we went into action. Mm. So we were never at the right place at the right time.
Right, so.
But mind you, this all altered later.
So come. Well, you were in England until
April.
I think
they went abroad April the 1st.
April the 1st.
Yes, and we landed at Le Havre.
Yes.
And we put up at Le Havre for a couple of days in a farm. I remember it because the straw was about 6 feet deep in this barn, and you could hear the rats running around in the bottom. Mm. But the only impression I have of that one was the son in the farm. He was about 27 years old, and he got his calling up papers to the French army. And we were only there 3 days, and he was weeping the whole time. So I thought, gosh, with allies like that, we don't need enemies.
How much had they told you about what was happening?
Nothing. They never tell you anything. The trouble is, you only hear from gossip and rumour, and the extraordinary thing is that it's usually right. The way it seeps down, you know.
And from Le Havre?
From Le Havre, we then...
Did you set up a clearance centre then?
Or pardon?
Were you just in transit when you were at Le Havre?
Oh, only a transit, yeah, only yes. A few days. Then we moved up to the... I can't remember the name of the village now, around Amiens, you know. And then Then we moved to Bethune, which is a... Do you know it?
Yes.
It's a transport, really. It was in those days. It was a rail centre and everything. And we were there when the fighting started.
That was sort of really with the fall of France, I suppose,
of Maiden. Oh, well, we woke up on May the 10th. It was my birthday. That's why I remember. And it shows how green we were. We were in a cinema. Built it upstairs. And we woke up to an air raid at dawn, you know. So we looked out the windows and everything, expecting to see the British fighters coming up, you know. We never saw one. And well, actually what happened, we saw a plane coming along, very, very low he was, and he passed almost at eye level. We see the pilot, and it had a big black cross on the side of him. So we said, hey, this is no joke, we don't do that again. But from there... No, actually, there's our sister unit, I don't know which one it was, the 12th or 13th, was operating under canvas, you know. And I was sent down there to help out because they had a case of cerebrospinal meningitis and they wanted a few extra men to do something about it. And the funny part about that was, I'm trying to think of the name of the drug. What's the group of drugs that they brought in just?
Penicillin,
yeah. Well, that group, you know. And they had this chap, and they hadn't got if they could get this, presumably, penicillin. I don't know what it was because I never saw it. And they reckoned he was going to die in any case. So they telephoned home to England and said, you've got this drug in use in England, but you haven't tried it out. They said, well, we've got a patient who's going to die in anyway. Will you send it over and let us try it out on him? And they did, and he recovered.
That's brilliant.
And it was like magic. I don't know which drug it was. I mean, we just gave a patient a drug if we were told to give it him, you know, that's all. And from there, well, that's when the fighting moved out. Do you want me to carry on?
Yes.
Well, we moved up then into Belgium. Of course, we were only kids. I was only 19 at the time. Well, just 20 when they were good. And we weren't like the modern boys are. They were very well developed. We were about at the age of about 15, you know, because, you didn't get the vote till you were 21. And we were only boys. And we moved up and we messed about for a few days. I don't know what we were doing.
Were you under canvas then?
Well, you put it where you could. We did have huge tents, you know, because we're mobile, which we would use as wards. We never got to using them because we were running after that most of the time. And so anyway, we moved up and there we had our first casualty. Now this is, I can only talk about personal things because I was a private. I didn't know what was going on. And we got a casualty and we stayed at a village for the night. We put up at a village for the night and a casualty was brought in. And my friend and I, in those days, anybody who got hurt or died, they got full military honours, you know. We would bath them and shave them and dress their wounds, you know, and present them nicely for the funeral, you see. And my friend and I were given this. And this poor chap, he was only 17, he'd put his age down, you know. And oh dear, he got his stomach shot to pieces, you know. It was a dreadful mess. And this is the day I grew up, by the way. And I got pretty upset about this, the waste of it. It's so stupid, you know. There's no point in it, you know. But anyway, we're doing this, and it was a dreadful mess and everything. And I said to my friend, I said, I can't do this job. This is what it's going to be like. I can't do this job. And he was quiet for a bit. And then the wisest thing I ever heard, he said, Bob, he says, for us, this marks the end of youth. God, how true it was. Well, from there, we moved around to one or two places. And I was always at the sort of the tail end, coming up with the luggage and things like that, you know. And our problem was, we moved so fast that we were frightened of getting separated from our unit. Because if you lost your unit, you were on your own. Nobody wanted you, you know. And anyway, eventually, we moved to two or three places, just stayed the night. We didn't know where we were going or what we were doing. And we moved down to...
Do you see many refugees coming the other way?
Pardon?
Do you see many refugees?
Oh, yes, at Bethune. Well, what happened was, so we heard, and I think it was right because it happened, the Belgian government appealed to any young man who had a bike to get down into France quick. And there were thousands of young fellas coming in from Belgium. Mind you, they were probably all captured by cycle bikes, you know. But the general refugees, not really. We met some. It was too fast. It was too fast. I'm trying to think of the name of the town, but we stopped in one town the night. And the unit moved off and left me sort of looking after, with a friend of mine, looking after, two friends of mine, looking after the baggage, you know. And we hadn't had anything to eat all day, so the town was empty. It had a German name, and it wasn't far from Armentiers. I can't remember its name now. Anyway, we were hungry, and it was, you know, the usual French town built round a square. There's nobody in it at all. And we went into one house, it was unlocked, and the table was set for dinner. They'd just gone, like that, it was so fast. And that night, I was there with the two for 2 months. I think they kept the friends together, gave them jobs together, and had my two friends with us, and we were looking after the luggage, you know, and waiting for a lorry to come and collect us. And in the middle of the night, a big ambulance convoy came in, and we kept very quiet until we heard the Oxford accents, you see, because the Germans, those that could speak English, could never get the accent right, you see. So we waited, always waited till we heard the Oxford accent, you see. And sure enough, we heard it. And then we showed ourselves, and there's this chap in command of this convoy. It was a big one, too. He said, "We're looking for the 11th CCS. I said, "Well, we're it, but we've moved." And he said, "Where are you?" I said, "I don't know. Don't tell me." And I said, "But I do know there's a train in the station, an ambulance train in the station." And he said, "Right, we'll go down there." So they commandeered my two friends and took them off and left me alone. And he went down there, and they loaded up that train that night with about 400 wounded. And the Germans came over at dawn and bombed the line either side. They didn't bomb the train, because that was a Red Cross, you see. I found the Germans quite honourable. It was the SS and the Gestapo that wasn't. The German army was I found them very honourable. Oh, because going back to when the day I woke up to that air raid, I was attached to that unit, and they had a German pilot who'd been shot down, and he said, "Have you got the Red Cross out?" And we said, "No." He said, "Put it out." And put it out, it was in a park, he said, "Put it out on the football pitch." So we put the unit did, put the Red Cross out, and they broke off the attack and went off and bombed the station. And so that, now that might have been coincidence, you see, you never know what happened. But, yes, I think they kept to the rules, more or less. Anyway, we arrived out at a place, I've got the picture outside, I meant to look it up. I couldn't find it now. We stayed at big house, country, it was built like a castle, you know, just outside. We didn't know where we were. It was just outside the beaches, about a mile from the beaches. And we stayed there a couple of days. We unloaded, we did a couple of days' work there.
And what would the day's work be?
Oh, well, wounded being brought in. Not a great number. Well, yeah, I suppose there would be, really, because there was I was on guard most of this time because I was always sort of bringing up the rear, you know, and always left to be on guard. So I didn't do much nursing. And we stayed there 2 or 3 days.
Did you get to chat to the wounded at all? Yes.
Yes.
What sort of stories were they telling?
Oh, we never had time to talk to them like that. Mm. We were always too busy. Anyway, next day we moved off, or a couple of days later we moved off, we moved down to the beach. So we, obviously, it was just, I went back there after the war, actually. And I've got the receipt from the hotel where we put up one night. And we went down to the beach, and we sat up in a cafe. Well, there was nothing there to pray at the Dunkirk beach. It's only a little, there wasn't even the village, just the odd houses and perhaps one hotel and a few houses along. It's on the French border, of course. And we sat up on the edge there. And we didn't realise at first what was happening. And then we realised that the evacuation was they were evacuating the army. And I think we were the only medical unit there, right on the beach.
So when you say you set up, what did that entail? Canvas?
No, we took over a cafe on the front.
This cafe, yes.
And all that separated us from the beach was a path of concrete, a metre wide, that was all. Mm. The tide didn't come up that far.
No.
You see, it was a huge beach. Mm. Gosh, it went up 20 miles up to Ostend. We only used it. We didn't realise what was happening at first. But the wounded started coming in and, I don't know, we were swamped. That's what it amounted to. I mean, we only had two surgeons. Well, we never did anything like a stomach wound because it was a three-hour surgery. I think the amount of surgery they gave to each patient was limited to 20 minutes. Mm. So if you got a stomach wound, you were just left to die, and that's all there was to it. They never did that. And actually, one Belgium surgical team joined us, so we had three surgeons at the time then. And we just kept going, and the main problem from a point of air attack, from a point of view of attack, was air. Dunkirk beach itself was a failure. The evacuation from the beach was a complete failure, because you can't take an army off a beach without any boats or anything. You see, true, the navy had arrived and was standing off, but the Dunkirk city, the harbour, the Germans had sunk all, ruined it by sinking all the boats in it, you see, so that you couldn't use it. And after about 3 or 4 days, they got some sort of a ramp going whereby the small boats could come in, like that one that we're collecting the money for to restore, and they collected them there and took them out to the ships. Now, they still carried on with the beach, but I think I saw the figures, but figures, you can't believe them because they alter every time they're quoted, you see. I think we rescued about 200,000 men from Dunkirk, and it was only about 18,000 they rescued from the beach because there was no way of getting off. The Navy used to send in their boats, and God, it takes 6 months to do it. So that it was pretty hopeless from the start, and we were absolutely swamped. We just couldn't do anything.
Did you have a problem getting bandages and supplies?
Doing what?
Getting bandages and supplies and medication.
No, we had all that. We had all our supplies and everything. But you can only talk about this from a sort of a personal point of view, I mean, because we were just the bottom of the heap, you know. But I was on one ward when a convoy came in. They unloaded about 60 wounded onto us, and they were in a dreadful state, some of them were. And I was the only one. They filled I had a room there in this... I think they must have taken over 2 or 3 cafes. I went there after the war, but they'd rebuilt the place, so you couldn't recognise it. And they loaded us in, and honestly, it was packed so tight you could only step between the handles of the stretchers to get round. And some of these fellows were in a very bad state. Nobody was doing anything about it. We were just swamped. But a surgeon walked through one day, and I literally grabbed his arm. You know, it's amazing, the surgeon was. And I literally grabbed his arm. I said, look, give me a minute or two. Look at these people. And he said, no, I'm too busy. I can't do that. I said, look, just tell me what to do then, you see. So he relented in the end. He said, all right, I'll give you 2 minutes. So he just went round. He didn't even look at anybody. He looked at them, but he didn't touch anybody. He was too busy. He went on to him. And he went off. He chose 14 of them, I remember. He said, half a grain of morphine each. Now, half a grain of morphine, we didn't have liquid, we had it in pill form. And he had to dissolve it in sterile water, you know, and put it in a syringe and give it that way, because obviously we couldn't carry liquids around, and we had to sterilise all our own thing. So I said to him, we were told how to do it. We'd been told how to do it, but they always said it would be a doctor's job. We'd never have to do that. And I said, he said, half a grain of morphine. I said, but I've never given morphine. He says, now's your time to learn, and walked off. really. So I spent my time, I got one of these syringes, as you see, and got everything. And I, and when I had it, got it sterilised and ready and all that, I picked one chap that I thought was going to die anyway, and he was in bad pain, so I gave him a shot in his backside. I did it all in the bag, I don't know why, but I think it was easiest, I think. And I stood back for half an hour to see what would happen. And he actually did quieten down, but I didn't know whether I was going to kill him or not. So I did the rest then, and it worked, you see. But what a responsibility for a kid of just 20 to take, you know. And then we used to have to go out on the beach. They had to keep the beach clear for morale purposes, you see. No, troops would get very upset if there were bodies lying around and people wounded lying around. So we cleared them immediately, you see. And that was pretty grim because it was so messy. I mean, people don't get wounded in real warfare, nice clean wounds like you get in hospitals here. You get things like a leg shot to pieces, you know, or their arms blown off, you know, and things like that. And it was terribly messy. And it was very upsetting because I'd never seen a dead person till that first one I saw, you know. And but there was no sort of organisation. But what we didn't realise was, till later, that Churchill issued an order, no wounded, to leave the wounded, because they couldn't take them off in the boats. Couldn't take a stretcher in these little boats, you see. And off we went. And we got all bunged up. And I don't know where they put them, but between the road, we were facing the south of the beach, and the main road was into France was at the back of us, and joining up there between the banks of houses, you know, but was a long underground passage. I think it must have been toilets or something, I don't know what it is. About 80 yards long it was. I don't know what it was for. It was like an underground toilet, you know. So we filled that up with patients.
What now, did you do with the dead?
Bury them. That was the job of the chaplains. They were good men. We had a Catholic, I'm a Catholic, you see, and we had a Catholic chaplain. So he gave me the job. He says, everybody who comes in, you look at his dog tags, and if you find the Catholics and report to me. And he did work too. But they were all good. The Church of England was good. And we had three, Catholic, Church of England, and other denominations. And they were all very, very good.
Did they have to bury them in mass graves in the end?
Yes, they buried them in the sand hills at the back. Presumably they'd have been dug up later, but they couldn't. But you see, it was the fighters that were the trouble. I think we did get bombed a few times. I seem to remember getting bombed. But you weren't interested in what was happening a quarter of a mile away, you see. That was none of your business. And what always amazes me is that people who were there with me when incidents happened had a different point of view than what I had. I never quite understand it to this day. I think it must be what they're doing and what they're thinking of at the time, you see. And our main concern was not to be caught out in the open on the beach, because the fighters used to come in all regularly, every quarter of an hour, every half hour, you see. And there's flipping spotting planes sitting up there, nobody even chased it away.
Where were the RAF during all
this? Oh, no, they weren't there. Well, you see, they were. Now, when I say that, that's not fair. They weren't there, but they wouldn't be there. They'd be taking on the German fighters before they 20 miles away, you know, before they got there. Only once did I see a German fighter, and that was the most frightening thing that I've ever done. One of them was, I was in the water. What I was doing in the water, I don't know. We were always in and out of the water, and yet we weren't sending wounded out. I think we were sending special ones, like if you got a, I remember we got a high naval officer in who got wounded, and then they sent him out. But I used to be in the water a lot, you know, with these boats. And of course, we were keeping an eye. We were in loading one of these boats. And three planes came and were skimming the sea about a mile out to sea. And, well, keep your eye on that boil. What any plane was doing that low, I don't know, because it was asking for trouble. But anyway, and then we watched them, and they banked into the beach and climbed a bit. And when they got to the beach, every gun on.